This message was recorded March 31, 2024. The speaker is David Simpson.
Now we look in our Bibles. We are in Ephesians in the New Testament, of course, and we are in chapter number 4. I remind you that the first three chapters are God's plan of redemption. And then the last chapters, 4, 5, and 6, are the believer's path in redemption. So we've gone through the first three chapters. We've gotten started into the fourth chapter, and we have a really wonderful passage to talk about. Connie and I have been married now for 54 plus years. And in our first year of marriage, we moved to a little town called New Harmony in Indiana. It's on the Wabash River, and I've always loved New Harmony. When we go back to southern Indiana, if I can get a breakaway, I'll drive out to New Harmony and look around and see what's there and see how it's changed. Of course, 50 years, a lot of things have changed, but a lot of things haven't. But one of the things that I have realized, maybe at that time or since then, I don't remember when this came to me, but the idea of New Harmony, and I realized that before there was a New Harmony, there was a disharmony. So there was a disharmony, and then they changed up, and they became a New Harmony. So when I see a church, for example, a church building, and the name of it is New Fellowship, I know that behind it somewhere is another group that probably could be called Broken Fellowship Baptist Church. So what reason I say that to you is because Paul is talking about this very thing. He's talking about unity in the church. He's talking about unity that is based upon the blood of Christ, upon the redemption of Christ, upon the righteousness that Christ earned, and God accepted, and God reckoned to His people. And so he's going to talk about things that are one here, one Spirit, and one Lord, and one God. That's the title of the message that I'm trying to bring to you today. And this is a oneness that is based upon the one gospel. There is only one gospel. Now, in my writing in Romans, I'll kind of let you know where I am. I've made it up to chapter 12. There are going to be 14 chapters, and I'm ready for chapter 12. So I have 12, 13, and 14 to get written. The last chapter is the gospel. Do you know that the first verse in Romans refers to the gospel of God? And the gospel of God is the theme that actually rides throughout the book of Romans. And there is only one gospel, and that's what Paul is telling us in that book. And so here, there is one gospel, and it is unity based upon that one gospel. I want us to read the first six verses, but our thoughts are 3, 4, 5, and 6. I therefore, verse 1, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy or consistent. That's a better way of saying that. Consistent with the calling, the vocation, the calling wherewith you are called. I want you to walk. I beseech you. I call out to you to walk consistent with the calling that you are confessing. And here's how you do it. Verse 2, with all lowliness and meekness, with long-suffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then you come to these ones here. There is one body and one Spirit, even as you are called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. Look at verse 3. The first word there is endeavoring. The word in the Greek doesn't mean anything to you, but I like the word just the way it sounds. It's spoudazo. And it kind of has the idea, just when I hear it, of get with it. Spoudazo. Get with it. It's a word that means to hasten, or to be eager, or to be diligent. It's used in Hebrews 4:1 where it says, let us labor therefore to enter into rest. That's two conflicting ideas. You're going to labor to get into rest. But that's what we have to do. Because it's not natural to us. It's unnatural to be in the rest of the gospel. It is more natural to us to be at rest in works and religion and fundamentalism. But we have to labor to enter into that rest with meditation and careful thought and resting in that gospel. But I like the way it says there, let us labor. And that word labor is spoudazo, to enter into rest. And Peter used the word in 2 Peter chapter 1 where he says, give diligence. Give diligence, there's the word, spoudazo, hasten, to make your election sure. Give diligence to it. You don't just take it for granted. The idea that people would have about us on the outside is that we are lackadaisical because we believe in election. If we believe that we're chosen, we become lackadaisical. No, the very opposite. Because we believe in election, we are diligent about this gospel and this message. So he says endeavoring, and then you have this to keep, to guard, to reserve, to preserve, to obey, to pay attention to. That's what that means. Endeavoring to keep. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. And then Jesus said, as he's praying to the Father in John 17 and verse 12, I kept them in my name. I guarded them. I reserved them. I preserved them. I caused them to obey and pay attention to. I kept them in my name. That's what he's doing for us today. We can't feel it, and we can't see at any one moment what God is doing. That's a part of his providence and preservation. But he's keeping us in his name. And then it's used in 2 Timothy 4 and 7 where Paul said, I have finished my course and I have kept, again that word, I have kept the faith. And Jude used it. And he referred to being preserved in Jesus Christ and called. So reserved and preserved and kept, caused to pay attention to. And then you come to really what this whole chapter is about this. Endeavoring to keep the unity, and that word unity means oneness or unanimity, and is only used in two places, this word, here and in verse 13. So you look it over to verse 13, till we all come in the unity of the faith. So this truth of unity and oneness, and unity is a major theme in Ephesians. I don't know that it's the single most important one, but it is a very important one. We've already seen it back in chapter 2, verses 14 and following, where he talks about the oneness between Jews and Gentiles being in one body. That's the idea. So it's not surprised that he speaks of it here. What is the key to being in unity? Well, if you look down to verse 16 in this fourth chapter, in verse 16 he says, from whom the whole body, so that's the church, fitly, properly joined together and compacted, held together by that which every joint supplieth, which every person in the congregation, the body supplies, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, making increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. So the key is love. Not just being here, but loving one another. Not just singing along, but loving one another, edifying one another in love. Paul uses this again in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 where he says, them who labor among you, esteem them very highly in love. So he's talking about the ministers that would come and be among them, esteem them very highly and do it in love. That's the key to keeping the unity of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is what in Galatians 5:22? It is love. In, now another phrase, of the Spirit, now in the bond of peace. The bond is that which holds or binds together. It can be used negatively. For example, in Acts 8 and verse 3, it speaks of the bond of iniquity. Some people are in the bond of iniquity. They can't seem to break it. They are too attached to it. But it also is used positively in Colossians 3:14. Put on charity, that is love, which is the bond of perfectness. So it is love But on this charity, it is the bond. But here he calls it the bond of peace. Eirene is the word. We get the lady's name Irene from this word. And sometimes Irene is the very opposite of this word, but it means harmony and tranquility. It is the antithesis to enmity, conflict, and war. You've probably read or heard, if you know your history, of what is called the Pax Romana. It's a Latin phrase that described the Roman peace. The Emperor Augustus enforced the nations that were around, that surrounded the Mediterranean Sea. He forced them to be at peace. It's called the Pax Romana. Well, if you have to force somebody to be at peace, it's not really much of a peace, is it? But from the Roman viewpoint, it was peace. The Grecians also spoke of peace, and it was the foundation of both national and personal welfare, they thought. They had a goddess named Irene, the goddess Irene, and that was a goddess of peace. And then, of course, the Christians came into the world, and they were preaching peace, and their peace goes all the way back into the Old Testament. There's a rich heritage of talking about peace in the Old Testament, and the Hebrews had a very name for it that you'll use today, shalom, and that word means I leave you in peace or be at peace, peace to you. So this idea of peace, this bond of peace, is a very important idea. Peace walks hand in hand with unity. Colossians 3:15, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts, which also you are called in one body, and be ye thankful. So I exhort you as your friend and as your pastor to be at peace in your hearts and be at peace in your homes. If you have a disagreement, talk it over, get it behind you, but walk in the bond of peace. Now, in verses 4 through 6, Paul makes a change. And so you have this separation here. These three verses stand alone, and really they stand alone in all of Paul's writing. There's nothing else exactly like this in any place of his writing. They go together. Verse 4 speaks of one thing. You'll notice that it speaks of the Spirit. See it there? The one body, one Spirit. And then verse 5 speaks of one Lord. That's, of course, Jesus Christ, the Son. And then verse 6, one God. So you have the Spirit spoken of first, and then Christ, the Son, in verse 5, the Lord, and then the Father spoken of in verse 6. And the number 3 is the number for God. It is the number that speaks of God. And each of these have three things. So you have three verses, and each of these have three truths, so that makes 9. So 3 divided by the 9, that becomes what's called a triad. And so each one of those is a triad, or you could have 3 threes if you're more comfortable with that, that's okay. But you have 3 triads or 3 threes that are here, and each of those are talking about God, and they are meant to be a perfect summation of God. 3 is the number of God, and these 3 triads build an emphasis, and they build a strength. But you also see another number here. While the number 3 isn't here, it is implied, but you have the number 1. And the number 1, of course, always is a single number. There's not another number in all the numbers that's like the number 1. Man, when you say to your wife, you're my number 1, you're telling them, there's not another like you. I love you as no other. You're my 1. You are my only. Now, when you look at the number 1, there are 7 of them here, but there are 9 truths. So you have 9 truths, 3 times the 3. I'm not that good at math, but I know 3 times 3 is 9. And so you have 3 triads, that makes 9, but you have 7 ones. What's the number for 7 in Hebrew numerology? Completeness. So what he's doing in a very symbolic and a figurative way, he's giving these 3 triads, speaking of God. He's giving this number 1 7 times that speaks of the completeness of God. Now, there's another thing here. You see the 2 words that begin verse 4, there is, there is. It's in italics, which means what? It's not there. It's not there. So it just begins one body, one spirit, and there's only one verb in all of these three triads. And that one verb is, you are called. But there is no connecting verb to any of these. So there's not a verb that introduces one body, and there is no verb that connects these three triads. And that's different. Because as you go back to verse 1, you see the verb where he says, I beseech you. And then he says, you are called. So there's another one. And then in verse 2, you have forbearing and long suffering. And in verse 3, you have endeavoring and you have to keep an infinitive. But here in these verses, you only have one verb and no connecting verb. And that is done on purpose, because what he's doing here again is he's building these nine truths together. So with that, what is the purpose of all of this? It is to show the basis, these nine truths show the basis of unity. So let me quickly talk about these nine things that are here, and we'll stop. All right. First of all, we come to verse number 4, and it simply reads, one body, one body. So what is the importance of that? But if you go back into the previous chapter, actually mostly into chapter 2, one body. So not a body of Jews and not a body of Gentiles. Not a body of those who were free and those who were slaves. Not a body of those who were rich and those who were poor. One body. You and I take that for granted, because we come in here and there is no distinguishing. There is equality among us. It's the same. But that's what he's talking about, one body. And Jesus prayed for that oneness in John 17. He said, make them one as you and I are one. I've thought about that a lot along the course of my ministry. Having been a pastor since I was 19, do you think that in that time I've seen some conflict? I certainly have. I've been through it. I've seen people argue and fuss and fight and division of this kind or another. And I thought about Jesus praying, make them one as you and I are one. In 1 Corinthians 12, there is a passage there from 12 to 27 where he's talking about this one body. And he said the body is, as the body, meaning your body, is one and yet has many members. And then he talks about the different parts of the body. The foot is not the hand, and the hand is not the foot. The hand and the foot is not the ear, and the ear is not the eye, and the eye is not the ear. Yet how could you walk without a foot? How can you hear without an ear? How can you see without an eye? How can you grasp without a hand? Each of them play a part, but then he refers to them as parts that are feeble. Parts that are feeble. Your little toe, pretty feeble. But you catch that little toe, if you're walking barefooted on something, and oh, that little feeble part becomes so important. So important. A feeble part. So among us, there may be some feeble parts, but we're all one. So then he says, one body. I need to hurry on, don't I? One spirit. One spirit. And 1 John 4, he talks about different spirits, but only one spirit. So why would he say that? Because in that day, they could talk about different spirits from different gods. But what he's meaning is there is just one spirit. Co-equal with God is the Holy Spirit. He quickens, animates, and enlivens the body. So one body, one spirit who enlivens that body, even as you are called in one hope of your calling. There's a lot there that we could talk about. But even as, meaning just as, also, and it marks a comparison, but also it makes a new truth. Just as there is one body and one spirit, you are called in one hope. What does this idea of calling mean? Well, it means to summons. It's not an invitation, but a summons. So when God calls you out of darkness and into light, he summons you to come. We know it's not a call that is an invitation because it's a holy calling. How could you call an invitation a holy calling? It's also called in Hebrews a heavenly calling. But the calling that God gives His people is not an invitation. Not a general call that goes out to all, because Peter said, as many as the Lord our God shall call. And Peter quoted Joel 2:32, where he says, the remnant whom the Lord shall call. It is a particular call, a definite call to that remnant. It is a irresistible call, not a resistible call for us to come. So Paul looked at it in Galatians 1:15. And he said, when it pleased God, who separated me, now he's talking about election, who separated me from my mother's womb and then called me by His grace. So Paul had nothing to do with his birth, his conception, but God chose me and then God called me later in life. Paul would have been roughly 30 years of age when God called him out of darkness and into light. And he called that the hope, the confident assurance that comes from the calling. It's also used that same way back in the first chapter. The hope that comes from calling. And Paul prays that they will know the hope that comes from the calling. It is God's initiative that calls. So that's the first triad. One body, one spirit, one hope that is connected with the calling. And then verse number 5, you come to the second triad, one Lord. Now you know who that is. That's Jesus Christ. Kyrios is the name for Lord. Christos is the name for Christ. This word Kyrios is a word that means owner or master or supreme ruler. It's used over 700 times in the New Testament, and 280 of those times, so nearly half of those times, are found in Paul's letters. In 2 Corinthians 11, in verse 4, he speaks of another Jesus and another gospel, but now he says there's just one Lord. One Lord. One faith. Now he's talking about the one body of faith. He's not talking about subjective faith, but he's talking about the objective faith. Not the act of believing, but the one settled body of truth. One singular, settled. It's not going to be added to, not going to be taken from. We spend our life studying, coming to the knowledge of this one settled body. Body, not one truth, but a body of truth. That one settled body of truth. Truth, not a lie. So I like that phrase. And that's what he's talking about, this one faith. One baptism. One baptism. There were many baptisms under the law, but only one baptism in the gospel. One mode, immersion. One message, the faith of the gospel. One means, given to the church by Christ, go and make disciples and baptize them. One model, Jesus' baptism in Matthew 3:16-17. He was baptized in a river. They didn't sprinkle him. Why would you be in a river and sprinkle somebody? He's in a river where he could lay him back. That's the one manner, death going down. Burial under the water and resurrection coming up out of the water and walking out of the water, walking in the newness of life. The baptism is the believer's confession of faith and the declaration of obedience. How interesting that Paul would say here, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one way for us to confess our faith openly, one baptism. Now we come to our third triad, so I'm almost finished. One God, Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. So you've had three ones and three ones and now one. One. There's our seven. Remember, one is the number for perfectness. Perfectness. Perfect is the Spirit and the Lord and God. One God. Now, they believed in many gods, correct? But there is only one God. It is monotheism as opposed to polytheism. Now, let me give you the word all that is used here. One God, one Father of all, who is above all and through you all. There, to that point, it has been used three times. And the Greek word that he uses for all, I want you to hear it so it's in your mind. It is pantone. Pan is the word that we use for all, and it is here because of its form. It is pantone. So it is used three times, and all of them are masculine, so they could be masculine or feminine or neuter, but they're masculine because they're masculine, they refer to people. That's what it means. So masculine referring to people, and so he's not just talking about one thing, but one God and Father of all people, above all people, and through all people. But it's not all of humanity. It is all of what the context is, and that means all of the one body. That's why I put that first. All of the one body. So you use that word, pantone. I'm going to give you another word for one in just a minute, but I want you to keep that in your mind. In Deuteronomy 4, they had a confession that they made, "Hear, O Lord, the Lord our God is one Lord." I'm pretty sure Paul had that in mind. Now look what it says about this one God. First of all, He is the Father of all the church, the Father of all in the body, Father of all the Jews and all the Gentiles. Not every Jew, not every Gentiles, but the body. See that? You wouldn't take this apart. Father of all the body. And then He's going to use some prepositions here. And so here's the first one that He uses. Above all, and that Greek preposition is epi, and it means over all the church, which means He has power, control, authority, He is sovereign, and not we ourselves. You come to the second preposition, through all, so it would be dia pantone, so it would be epi pantone, and now it's dia pantone, through all, and then in you all, and that just is en, or we would spell it in, but it's en pantone. So these three prepositions are important when he puts them together like this. It's over, means God's working sovereignty. Dia, through, God's working providence. And in means God's working presence. These three prepositions then explain our relationship to God. They are giving an overall explanation of our relationship to God. He is over us. He is through us, and He is in us. These prepositions speak of the three in one God. God is over all, God the Son is through all, and the Holy Spirit is in all. And this unit, these three, because of that, there is only one, didn't say that, but there is only one article that is used here, and that one article puts these three together. And so it makes one unit, and they are standing in apposition to the one God. And the apposition means it is an explanation, a further explanation of the one God. This one God is above all, through all, and in you all. Have I lost you in all of this? It's a way of grammatically putting this together so that it is an explanation of God. Now I want you to look at one last thing. I'm about to finish. You remember I gave you the word pantone. Now he's going to change this last word all is not pantone. Father of all, pantone. Above all, pantone. Through all, pantone. Now he changes. It's spelled the same for us, but it's not pantone. It's pasen. And it's not all, but each. So now what does he say? It's a wonderful thing that he says. Over all, above all, through all, and now in each. Each of you. Isn't that a wonderful thing? You can't see it just by looking at it with English, but it's in each of you. Each of you individually. Each of you inclusively. He does something else. This time he uses the you, and it is a plural, personal pronoun, and it is all the body of Christ, but then he changes to that pasen, and it's in each of you. So it is all of you and each of you. Just an incredible thing that he says here. It's all of you and each of you. What did Peter say? Cast all your cares upon him, for he cares for you. Pass in, each of you. He cares for each of you. So I say to you this morning from the depth of my heart, God cares for you. You're his. God cares for you. You can't see all of it, but he's taking care of you. Same personal pronoun, you meaning. These three threes, these three triads declare the sovereignty of God in all things, especially in the salvation of God's elect that he calls here his body. The Father purposed it to elect the people to be his own. The Son executed this salvation to become the substitute for his people, to enter into our place and our sin be put upon him. And the Holy Spirit reveals it to be his elect people, all of you and each of you.